Hi, welcome to Stoner. This week on the show, I talked to Amanda Chicago Lewis. You might remember her from one of the first episodes of Stoner. She is a weed reporter, and she has a big story in GQ about a mysterious business group that she uncovered during her many weird forays into weed business conferences that appears to be trying to patent various marijuana strains. It has pretty giant implications for the industry as a whole, and it's a fascinating and fairly hilarious story. So I'll let her tell it. Amanda.
Aaron.
So I love reading the story this morning. At first, I did not realize that it was you who was writing the story. It was like one of those pocket kind of experiences where I was reading it on the app, and I didn't know it was someone who I really liked, and I was really enjoying reading the story. And then it occurred to me, wow, I bet Amanda would be unhappy that someone else had gotten this story who wasn't her. And I was like, wait a minute, this person sounds kind of like Amanda Chicago Lewis, because the last time I talked to you, and people who haven't heard that interview are totally encouraged to go back and listen to it, I was kind of asking you about what a weed reporter does in 2017. And I would say your description could be paraphrased into texting a lot of weird sources, going to weird conferences and festivals, and generally tracing a weird story wherever it goes. And that's kind of where this story picks up.
Yeah, I think this is the story where everyone finally understands that I'm actually just like a weed socialite. I do a lot of this. I mean, like this is, you know, the parties described in the article are a very small percentage of the parties I've been to this year alone.
What party were you at when the story started?
It was a party for Jane West new glassware line in Las Vegas during the Marijuana Business Daily conference. So Jane West is like a pretty prominent figure in the cannabis world. Are you familiar with her?
Yeah, I know the name.
Yeah, so she was launching this new line of bongs and pipes, and it was one of those, so the conferences in Vegas are always sort of fun because it's like everyone who's anyone is in town, and, you know, you sort of fill up your dance card with all these different options about different parties, you know, and this was like stop two of like six or seven. And then that night ended like at a strip club with a Colorado legislator and some prominent lawyers. Actually, that's not where the night ended. The night went there and then ended other places, but
are you in your own mind thinking about stories that are not the story that is being sold by the conference? Because like someone coming out with a new line of bongs does not seem newsworthy, or it's certainly not going to be published in GQ.
Yeah, no. I mean, like I have conversations, lunches, phone calls, meetings all the time that are not directed towards specific stories. I go to parties all the time, not intending to write about those events.
Yeah.
You know, it's just excuses for all the key people to be in person together.
What are the social dynamics like there?
I mean, I would say from my perspective, you know, trust is really important in the cannabis industry, because even as it legalizes, so many aspects of it are still illegal or somewhat dubious. And so you really need to have that like in-person relationship with someone. Like a lot of business relationships get cemented while burning a joint, you know, and that's sort of an important bonding thing. And that also means that like what you really want is to meet people in person and have them have like a face to your name and have your phone, their phone number in your phone. Because if I just DM some company's Instagram account or like try to get in touch through their, you know, official PR channel, if they have one, it can be really impossible to get to the people who actually know what they're talking about. But when I meet people in person, it's much easier. And then later, it's much easier to like call on them and be like, hey, remember we met at this thing? I just wanted to ask you really quickly about something. And they're like, yeah, sure. And that's, you know, that's how I develop sources.
And if you're trying to keep a secret under your hat, being really high in Las Vegas at a conference with a bunch of other weed people, that's a tough secret keeping area.
Well, maybe for you, but I think most of these people are experts at being high.
And keeping secrets.
Yeah, and keeping secrets and keeping their cool. And I think that anyone in the cannabis industry who isn't will just, abstain because it ends up being sort of a business party type situation. You know, there's a lot of thirst in the room. There's a lot of, actually, one of my sources, a major grower, just texted me that he really liked the line in the opening of the story about everybody trying to act like they're better positioned than everybody else there, but at the same time, like desperately trying to get information out of people. So there is sort of that vibe where people are like posturing,
yeah.
But at the same time, they're like, what do you have? What do you have? Do you have a license in this town? Oh, are you working with these people? Oh, well, I've got this thing. But also, do you know these people? You know, there's sort of a, and there's a lot of like, who do you know? Not in the terms of like Hollywood name dropping, but just, this is such a, there's such a like storied, extended group of friends, history behind this industry that you sort of need cred to get in with people. And I think part of it is that things are changing so rapidly. You don't know who actually has maybe the money that you need to get mm-hmm. access to. You don't know who has the growing expertise that maybe you've been looking for in your company.
Where is the money coming from most of these ventures? Like, once you start looking at like, not where, not like who's making the money, but like where, when, if you want to start something, you know, let's say into the millions, where do you go for that kind of money to start a marijuana business?
So it has to be private equity, family offices, high net worth individuals. It all has to be sort of private and on the low. Even, you know, Privateer Holdings, which is like a major company that has money from Founders Fund, Peter Thiel's people, they just announced like $50-something million and you know, a new raise in the last like 2 days. And even that, like, you won't be able to trace out where that money came from. So it's all very secretive. Like, this is not the first time, and certainly is not the last time, I have attempted to find where the money was behind something and come up, you know, with only a couple of half partial answers.
Tell us what you heard and where it took you.
Yeah. So I met this guy, Magley Holmes, who runs a lab in Portland. And he told me that there was a mysterious billionaire who was buying up all of the patents on marijuana, and that this obscure company that seemed to have no other assets had these extremely broad patents on entire categories of cannabis covering many, many, many strains. And when he described what one of them was to me, I was like, how is that even possible? And, you know, we, at this point, so we met at the party, we started talking, we got together the next day at this like central bar in the casino where all this Vegas stuff happens. And he told me more about it, but he had to like run to a flight. And so he like told me all this like terrifying information. And then he like disappeared and like went to the airport. And I was totally baffled. And I was like, is this guy crazy? You know, is he just trying to promote his own business? What's going on? And of course, because it's Vegas and everybody's there, I like stumbled down the hall. I immediately ran into somebody who confirmed everything that he had said, sent me this really important memo, immediately ran into the person who had written the memo, you know, who pushed me over to like one of the most important owners, dispensary owners in the business, who was standing right there, who was also really concerned about this as an issue. And so I think partly it was helped by the fact that I was physically in a location where all of the important figures were within 100 yards of each other. And so the preliminary, is this a thing reporting took 20 minutes.
So you ended up like getting this lead and starting it to pursue it down the rabbit hole, much in the cable thriller model of Follow the Money. So the money kind of took you to a series of weird shell corporations, you know, businesses where the one person who you were able to track down who'd been a part of it said, well, I don't work with them anymore. And they're working mm-hmm. at a new business that weirdly has some of the same employees. I won't make you recount the whole thing because it's like a cable thriller, pretty complicated web, intentionally pretty complicated web. But what did you ultimately find about the people who are behind this theoretically tentative plan to patent a bunch of marijuana strains?
Well, so first of all, it's not tentative. Three very broad patents have already been issued. And the estimate from one of the leading pot geneticists at Steep Hill, which is a major lab in Northern California, was that I think the existing patents, and I think that was when there was only two, would cover between a third and half the market or something like that in terms of how many strains were already going to be covered by this. So that doesn't, we don't know whether it's going to be enforceable, but like the patents are already out there and the rest of the applications are pending.
There's two things this echoes that you cite in the story. One is the aggressive drive that Monsanto and other big agro companies had to patent plants, patent crops. Mm-hmm. And that's like a storied history, and it's, you know, pretty terrifying idea on several levels. And there's lots of Monsanto paranoia floating around
Yep.
there.
I now understand that paranoia in great detail.
And the other story is just the general story of when is big business going to come for the weed industry? Usually, a lot of times when someone's on the show, they'll say, wow, like I just, you know, I wish it could stay small. I wish it could stay local, but I'm pretty cynical about it. And no one really knows when they think something like that, what the form that big business is going to take. But it's a mm-hmm. pretty unified feeling I have when I talk to people in different states, different professions, that something is coming. There's an iceberg in the water.
Yeah, but I think, and this might be it, but I also think that like there's this like nostalgia there for something that isn't real. You know, there's sort of this like idea that there are these like beautiful, wonderful old people who've been growing cannabis for their entire lives and they don't participate in capitalism and they don't like mainstream society and they're just growing weed because they want to bring other people joy and medicine and like, yeah, there's like kind of people like that. I've met people like that. But for the most part, people who are pushing that narrative are full of shit. But definitely the nostalgia tends to ignore the fact that drug dealing is a business and that anybody who's been doing it for a long time was doing it for the money and they didn't have to pay taxes. And it was pretty easy money. And you could like live off grid and make, you know, $100,000 a year without doing that much work and not participating in some sort of weird corporate thing that you thought was annoying and stressful.
I mean, it's important to note that patents aren't ironclad. The fact that you can squeeze a patent by someone in the patent office who is maybe totally uninterested in marijuana or uninformed or, you know, a million things doesn't necessarily mean like every time you smoke weed for the next 100 years, you're going to be like paying a license fee to these people who patented your strain in 2017. So I would think here that even though these patents have been issued, it's still up in the air what that really means.
Right. It could take a really long time to mount a challenge. And I would say, like, you know, they were put through the ringer by the patent office. I've seen video of Michael Baucus, who was like the lead patent inventor, talking about the process of the patent office saying, well, this doesn't look right. And then they would have to, he would have to like drive somewhere and go get something and prove to them that they were doing, you know, this kind of breeding or whatever. And, it, you know, it's like a multi-year process. And part of it is that these people have so much money at their disposal that they hired, you know, one of the top lawyers in DC to make this happen for them. Part of it, I think, is this idea of, you know, the code switcher thing that I mentioned in the story, which is like the people in the pot industry who are going to be the most powerful and have the most power right now are people who can speak black market and can speak outlaw, but can also speak to the investors and can speak to the Wall Street people. And that is definitely what most of the people in this group are.
So how did Montel Williams cross paths with this story?
You know, Mowgli, actually the guy who got me started on the story originally, was like, and I heard that Montel Williams might be somehow involved. Like in my original notes, I just have Montel Williams written down from that conversation. And I even, when I met with Kevin Nguyen, my like brilliant, brilliant editor at GQ, originally, I didn't even remember that Montel Williams was part of it. And I like pitched him the story without even mentioning it. And then I texted him later when I was on the plane and I was like, oh, Montel Williams is involved. And he was like, what? Okay, now we're like, we want to do this. Like, we're going to try and make this story happen. It sounds crazy. So he used to work with the group of people that seemed to be behind the patent.
To an outsider, it feels like there's these businesses that operate at the ground level that are
yeah.
growing weed, selling weed. And then there's these loftier businesses that do things like developing new products and potentially are doing things that I don't even know about, that are raising money less on like this month, this week, we are going to sell this stuff, and more in the way a startup does, where you're raising a lot of money and you're saying in the future, we're going to create something that's huge.
Yeah. I mean, that's what Malgwe's company is doing.
Yeah. Tell me about how those kind of businesses work in your experience.
I mean, I think either you're trying to push publicity for yourself to raise money, and in reality, you don't actually touch the plant or don't yet touch the plant, and so you're probably not doing anything illegal, or like your company is some kind of turnkey, like you're like a turnkey company. There are all these ways that you can distance yourself from actually touching marijuana and like protect yourself from legal consequences. And so the more public you are about what you're doing, the more likely it is that you don't touch the marijuana plant. And so people who are actually involved in the business and are making money, you know, hand over fist, like try to avoid publicity for the most part.
Let's just imagine that these patents are real and they are enforceable. Yeah. I don't even know that me and you could even do a back of the envelope of how valuable that really is, because we would be setting it based on the current historical moment, but anyone who is an investor would also be gambling on the potential future with national legalization. Then how much are these patents worth? Well, what if you can enforce them internationally? They're even worth more.
You know, there's a lot of bogus numbers in the industry floating around. There are people, though, that I trust, and the people that I trust do think that the national market is between $40 and $50 billion at a minimum, and that's the people at Cannabis Benchmarks. They're very smart.
Yeah.
And I think that that's legitimate. You know, I think that Reggie, the guy at Seed Hill, estimated that the patents would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and I think that is legitimate. I mean, I think if they get all the patents that they want and they are able to enforce them, you know, for I think it's something like 20 years, they will make a ton of money, and they will have maybe, you know, invested perhaps $5 million to make $500 million.
Is it safe to say then, if the potential financial upside is that extreme, that there's other people, not necessarily with this exact plan, but there are other business interests trying to find angles like this that are pharmaceutical in nature, that are trying to swallow the industry whole?
Oh yeah, everyone's trying to find an angle. And pharmaceutical, it would be so much easier because the people who are already in power essentially would be able to continue to have power.
We're seeing in the story the beginnings of how it could become a big business explosion, and not in the way it has been before, where, yes, there's lots of money flowing in, but there hasn't been a hit. There's not a Google that has come out of the marijuana industry. I'm not suggesting that this is it, but it sort of allows you even to think about, could there be one company that holds, say, more than 50% of the overall American marijuana market? If other industries are our example, that does happen.
Yeah. In the end, you know, I made it to this person that I thought might have been the mysterious billionaire that Malgwe had heard about, who certainly seemed to be very connected to these businesses, though, you know, I was being told that he had no involvement in the patents. He seemed to be funding some of the people who are in this extended universe of personnel that work at the companies that seem to be related to each other, but apparently aren't. And then, you know, his lawyers came back at the very end with this response about how he may be involved with a multinational public company that may have been pursuing interests in cannabis intellectual property. And I was like, what? Like, this was days before we closed the story that we were getting final stuff from his lawyers. And this idea of like a public multinational company suddenly being in the mix, when I had really assumed this was like private folks funding this, it was very disorienting. I mean, there were some paranoid folks who were like, Monsanto's behind the whole thing. And I was like, okay, that's probably not true. And now I don't think that's true, but I do feel like there's something going on that's even weirder than I had even initially imagined.
I didn't know at the end of the story whether to feel like this is the most surprising turn of events, or nothing could be more appropriate than the people trying to patent weed in America is a conglomerate with a lead investor who's a secretive Iranian multi-multi-millionaire from a cosmetics fortune who may have teamed up with Montel Williams. It's a pretty weed story.
It's very weird. There's only crazy characters. And I think when you were like talking about, you know, there hasn't been a Google of marijuana. And I think the biggest reason why there hasn't been a Google of marijuana yet, though Weed Maps would definitely try to argue that they are the Google of marijuana, you are not going to get major institutional investors and total transparency and a lot of due diligence and trustworthy companies and people involved until you see federal legalization.
It's incredible that we're even talking about a patent for something that could still land you in jail for possessing.
I know. Well, the USPTO quote didn't make it into the article, but it was essentially like, just because you have a patent on something doesn't mean you could use it or sell it, which I guess is sort of like if I tried to get a patent on like a special kind of like nuclear bomb that I designed in my home, like you do, they might be like, sure, here's your patent. Don't try to use it.
It's a strange thing because as I understand it, patents often ask you to describe how you developed the product that's being patented. And to develop the products that are being named here, you would have had to commit at least a federal crime.
Yeah. And I would say here that legally being careful, I would say that I spoke to leading cannabis attorney Henry Wykowski, who is a big deal and has argued a bunch of federal cases involving cannabis on behalf of some pretty major people. And he said, you know, it would be impossible to have gotten these patents without breaking federal law in some way.
Okay, well, we've already done a Peak Experiences since you are a generous second-time guest on this show. So I'm going to do, rather than do Peak Experiences again, I'm going to ask you about some updated experiences, maybe with an LA focus. Is that cool?
Okay, yeah.
So last time I asked you what your favorite way to consume marijuana is, and I'm looking for an update. So among all the gazillion new products that have hit the market, really there's like more things out there that you could buy than I would have possibly imagined. Has anything caught your eye? Do you think anything would be something that you'd make a part of your life or you'd recommend to others?
Yeah. One thing I'm really into right now is Cinnamon Breeze Mints, B-R-E-E-Z. They have 5 milligrams of THC and 5 milligrams of CBD in each one. They are very easy to travel with because they look like Altoids. And they are small and they pack, you know, a good punch depending on what you need. They have other kinds. They have 5 milligrams of THC and they have a, I think, 20 or 25 milligram mint. But the cinnamon ones are the ones I'm super into. I ate like 6 of those yesterday.
Mints would be a problem for me because I would just start firing them in as a pure reaction to the mintiness. But like, how do you know when to take the next one? How do you kind of keep your even keel when you're popping 6 mints a day?
Well, I love that you assumed I popped those 6 mints slowly over the course of the day.
Power mouth. You're like me and gum.
I think I had 4 on the airplane and then 2, like 2 hours later.
Four like all at once. So you took like a 20 milligram. Okay. So
I mean, 20 and 20. Yeah.
So in some ways, would it be fair to say that for people who are curious about edibles microdosing, getting something in 5 milligrams doesn't necessarily mean you're going to take a 5 milligram dose. It just allows you to very simply titrate a dose of any size using 5 milligrams as your building block.
Yeah, or even something smaller. I mean, I think, look, if you're a noob and you're in California and you have access to dispensary products through one mechanism or another, there are 3 different things that I would say you could try that I recommend to friends. So the cinnamon breeze mint, like 1 cinnamon breeze mint would be a good way, especially if you've had anxiety issues with weed in the past where it's sent you your mind racing and you've been really paranoid and that's something you worry about. Try 1 breeze cinnamon mint. Or Kiva makes a mint now called Petra, and those are 2.5 THC milligrams. So that's even less. You could try.
Is that about the smallest you can buy? Can you get 1 milligram or is 2.5 your body?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. 1 milligram.
So then what you'd want to look toward is the Care by Design line of sublingual sprays, because you could find those in a lot of places and they're very good. And those come in a variety of ratios, starting at 1:1, which is the same ratio as the cinnamon breeze mints, and going all the way up, I think, to 18:1, at being like for every 18 parts of CBD, there's one part THC. And so the 18:1 is not going to be psychoactive at all. But if you get like a 2:1 spray and you do like one spray in your mouth under your tongue, which, by the way, is the fastest way to feel the effects from cannabis is sublingually, I think that's 1.3 milligrams of THC and therefore 2.6 milligrams of CBD. So that'll be very light.
For you, as I think I asked you last time to recommend a stoned viewing experience, and you said that all of your viewing experiences were stoned. Any particular
many of them
particularly
are.
Memorable ones?
Man, you know, like the first time you watch, what is it, like the jungle part of Planet Earth?
Wow. A lot of nods for Planet Earth out here. A lot of nods.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, like there's like those time lapses that are really mind-blowing. I don't know. It's like, whatever am I, it's like, what am I watching in general? Like, that's what you're asking me.
Last question. So you're still a weed reporter. No plans to change in the future, I assume.
No plans. Yeah.
Where do you see your relationship with marijuana going, both personally and professionally, going forward from here? What has it been like being a person whose work and life has really revolved around marijuana? Are either of them more or less fun than they used to be?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's like a process of refining my tastes and gaining expertise. You know, sometimes I get tired of talking about it, but usually that's just if I'm, it has more to do with like, am I talking to somebody who seems like they suck? So I don't want to talk to them in general. But like, you know, I enjoy helping people become educated about how to better use marijuana, because there's all these people who smoke a ton of weed that they're getting from their dealers all over the country who don't know, you know, how to dose edibles and who don't know, you know, what CBD is and who don't know, you know, how to figure a lot of the stuff that's happening out. And I feel like I not only move through like normal people who smoke weed spaces, but like move through spaces where there are all these experts and, you know, I'm the noob in those spaces. So it helps. I get all my questions answered and then I'm able to turn around and try and pass as much of that on as possible. And in terms of the reporting, I mean, I think it'll continue to be very strange and interesting in this period before federal legalization.
Yeah.
And it's unclear when that will happen. And
it
so,
might get boring sometime in the future, but not anytime soon.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think like once federal legalization kicks in, there could be this sort of rapid consolidation and things could change really quickly. And yeah, well, I, you know, hopefully I'll pull off like a Kara Swisher thing. And like once all these like small fry are hugely powerful people, they still take my calls.
You'll be like the only person who still intimidates them.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yes.
Got it. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do a long interview on the first day that you had the story out. Congratulations again. I hope
Thanks,
you,
friend.
I hope you take yourself out for a nice pre-roll or something tonight.
Thank you.
And that was Stoner. You can read the article we were talking about in the newest GQ or on their website. This episode was edited by Courtney Harrell. All our visual branding is by Mickey Duje. Our associate producer is Justine Dom. We come to you every Tuesday with a new show featuring interviews with people who are involved in the marijuana economy, or maybe just enjoy marijuana, or maybe are new to it and are getting into it. If you want to get in touch, hi, hi@stoner.co. See you next Tuesday.